The following is an interview with Eliska A. Hasek, E-L-I-S-K-A-H-A-S-E-K, writing and editing assistant in the Office of Research and Messages. The interview was conducted by Susan Yowell on October 2, 1974, in Ms. Hasek's office, room 117 of the old executive office building. And then we decided to start taping more out of convenience than anything else.
Yeah.
And just getting a very basic overview of what you were. Actually, you're a little bit unusual in the sense that you've carried over from several administrations
to the other. Yeah.
So that's kind of,
People
don't really, it's difficult to draw an organization chart for the White House anyway.
Because it changes from day to day.
Where it changes from day to day and from person to person.
Yeah.
So we feel that we're trying to fill in at least some of that.
Yeah.
Actually, did you do one of those resumes or job books, whatever they called them in 72?
Yes.
We started this, of course, before those were requested, but for the people who were there at that particular time.
Yeah.
We think that those will be very good, assuming that they're available.
Yeah.
Of course, they'll be slanted individually to the office because, in a way, those were wish books in the sense of people requesting that they thought this should be done or proposed.
Yes.
Well, anyway, I won't take up more of your time than I have to. When did you first come to the White House?
I came here in September of 1963.
And at that time, did you apply to come here? How did you?
I had just graduated from the Foreign Service School at Georgetown University, and I was really contemplating going into the Foreign Service, but I hadn't been a citizen long enough, so I was informed to take the Foreign Service entrance examination, because at that time they had some sort of a rule that you had to be a citizen 10 years, and I'd only been 1 7. And that's since been revoked, I understand, but anyway. And so one of the people whom I had interviewed with at the State Department suggested that a friend of his would be soon without an administrative assistant because she was getting married, and how would I like to go by his office at the White House and see if I'd like to, you know, work for him or something. So I went by, and he hired me right there. And of course, I had absolutely no knowledge of or interest in, really, domestic politics. I mean, it's something that I'd never been involved in, knew very little about. And so it was a whole new world, and I started out by editing, mainly. I worked on the galleys, the Kennedy Public Papers, for a long time. And
were you on the Federal Register staff?
No, I was on the White House staff right from the start. And then started getting into some writing and some administrative work for the man I was working for, you know, organizing his office.
Who were you?
I think this was work for Fred Holborn. And then Fred Holborn, with the new administration, with the Johnson administration, I was asked to stay on by Bill Moyers. And then Bill's brother, Jim Moyers, came on, and Bill asked me if I would, you know, serve as his administrative assistant. In the meantime, Fred Holborn had left because he'd been part of the old staff. And I said that was just fine and I'd love to stay, and had a wonderful year working for Jim, who was just an exceptional person. And then in a year later, he died very tragically. And so there was the question of, you know, what to do next.
Here's your letter, I think.
Where were we?
Jim Moyers.
Right. And then he died, and then what was I going to do then? And so then I had wanted again to get into the State Department, and I at that time Saul Linowitz had become the U.S. ambassador to the OAS, and Latin America was one of my specialties or great interests, and I spoke Spanish, still speak it by, I don't know, it's bilingual in Spanish and English. So Linowitz needed someone on his staff who was bilingual in Spanish and English and asked me to join his staff. So I, Bill Moyers that time called over there to sort of break the freeze that, you know, was put on hiring in the departments at that time, and everything was all set when one fine morning Bob Kintner called me into his office and said that the president had was offering me a 3-grade promotion and would like me to stay on. So that was the end of working for Linowitz, and I was promoted up 3 grades and you know, started getting more and more into the writing of these messages, and I did in the Johnson administration some Rose Garden statements and things of that, you know, of that nature. And then again at the end of the Johnson administration, I thought of leaving and was looking around for a job in New York and, you know, other places. And at that time, Jim Keogh called me and said that he had heard that I was, and by that time I was the head of the office that handled messages for all the president's messages to national organizations and individuals and that kind of thing. And so Jim Keogh called me from New York and said, you know, that he would like me to stay at least through the transition period, and if I would, because he'd heard that there was so much in this office that was institutionalized and that, you know, needed to be passed on from administration to administration. And so I said that I would be delighted, because all I had contemplated was a long vacation. And so I stayed on, and I so enjoyed working with Jim Moyer, Jim Keogh rather. He was a wonderful person. And so I stayed on with him when he was here 2 years, and then with Ray Price and Dave Berg, and then you know the rest, and here I am.
Was the job essentially the same when the Nixon administration came in? Was it the organization the same in the sense of being under the Office of Research and Messages, or whatever it was called at
the
time?
Well, that organization took shape in the Johnson administration. Kennedy didn't really have a writing staff or, you know, an organization that was as complete as the one that was started in the Johnson administration. This was continued, you know, more or less the same in the Nixon administration. I think that in my own particular office, the number of messages sent out by the president was expanded considerably in the Nixon administration. Our policies were greatly relaxed from the Johnson days, and many more things were done that were not done directly over the president's signature in the Johnson administration. There was the great difference that in the Johnson administration, the president himself saw and signed most of the statements that were done by my office, whereas in this administration, the Nixon administration, that wasn't so. They were mostly routinely, you know, signed by machine and that sort of thing.
Could you describe the general types of messages that you did?
Well, it's a little hard to describe them because they sort of cover such a wide gamut of subjects, but essentially they're messages of greeting from the president to national organizations at their national conventions. The policy of my office, the practice here, is to check into each one of these organizations with the department under which they, you know, the governmental department under which they might fall, to check whether the organization deserves such recognition from the president, what their programs are, how their programs connect with federal programs, that kind of thing, so that the message can be naturally partially fluff, because it's just, you know, it is a greeting to the group, but so that also we can have one or two or three sometimes paragraphs of substance indicating the president's knowledge of the work of this organization as it relates to, you know, national goals and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, we have, of course, we handle all sorts of requests for special testimonials to individuals who are being honored. And there again, you know, you have the question of who the individual is. Does the president know him? Should he be recognized in this way at a national event? Same thing with awards, national awards that are given. Is this an award we want to go on recognizing every year? Should we recognize it only when it's given to an individual whom the president knows? You know, that sort of thing. Naturally, it's important to check out all of these individuals and organizations, because many times it does happen that a maverick request comes through that should not be honored, and in those cases it's important to protect the president, because you know just attach his name to somebody.
Does your office make the decision on who
Yes.
is to receive?
My office receives from the mailroom directly masses of correspondence each day. From that, we sort out, we separate it into several categories. One, those requests that should be sent to departments or agencies to be acknowledged in the departments or agencies, either just as a polite reply to the individual who writes in, or as a message from the secretary of the department on behalf of the president. Now, in many cases, we do this in cases that don't qualify because of an existing policy for presidential messages, but which at the same time do deserve, you know, the administration's and the president's recognition. And the president in this way asks a member of his cabinet, you know, in effect to extend greetings on his behalf to the individual or group. And so, you know, this is done by my office. Then there are certain other requests that are answered by letters from staff members on behalf of the president. Also, you know, things of a local nature or things that that would just not qualify for a presidential message because of the precedent that it would set. I mean, in other words, if you recognize one local chapter of a national organization, it is not very fair, because, you know, if you don't recognize every single local chapter of that national organization, then, you know, it causes all sorts of feelings of jealousy and resentment and so on. So there has to be, it's very important to have a central message office, not only so that you avoid duplication, because we may get three requests into this office for the same event from different individuals and different sources. You see. So for that reason, it's important, and then for the and then secondly, also for the for protecting the president and checking out these things so that they're legitimate requests and legitimate organizations and so on, and also thirdly for the reason that you want to be fair to everybody, and once you do something, you have in effect set a precedent for other similar organizations and for years to come, so that you know, usually you have to make a decision. I mean, we decide, we will honor requests for messages to national groups. We will honor requests for messages to those groups that may not be national but are observing a one-time sort of anniversary, like 100th. We will stay away from sending messages on anniversaries, even to commercial institutions, such as banks, companies, that sort of thing, directly over the president's signature, because one takes the chance of having the organization use that message in a commercial way, which would not be appropriate. So, in order, we do not make any exceptions to this particular rule, because, you know, if you make an exception, you have to do it for the next guy, and, you know, you're not sure that everybody's going to comply with the request not to use it commercially, and so, you know, it's just not done for anybody. And, you know, there are things like, I mean, there are many, they're mostly in my head now. I mean, I've never really bothered to write, you know, everything down like that. But one does have to be careful, because there have been things that have backfired and that have, you know, in checking, been found out to be, you know, on worthy of recognition.
From whom you receive guidance on what types of messages should be approved, in the sense of what types of organizations that may be compatible with the administration's policy?
It's not a question of compatibility as much as it is of just whether or not it is a legitimate group performing a legitimate public service. I mean, many organizations to which we've sent messages to have been at variance with the administration, but at the same time, they haven't been disruptive of the public good. You know, there's a difference, and so, you know, we generally, I rely very heavily on the public information offices of the departments and agencies, and have a liaison in each of those departments. They do my research work for me, and then it's coordinated by my office and submitted to me in memo form from the head of the, you know, public affairs department of whatever the agency happens to be. And then I usually dictate the draft based on the information that's supplied me from, you know, by the departments and agencies. In cases of individuals being honored, you know, I would check with the appropriate person here on the White House staff who might know the president's relationship with that particular individual, how long he's known him, you know, what sort of experiences and memories the association spans, and that kind of thing. In cases of personal friends, of course, the president's personal secretary and so on. So, you know, there are many people whom I check with many times, in addition to coordinating with the public affairs office of the particular department. I will also coordinate it and check it out with a member of the domestic council staff or of the national security staff here, or, you know, depending on what the area is. Yes.
How many, or in proportion, how many requests do you receive directly from members of the White House staff? Particularly, I'm thinking that you might receive a number of requests from those offices which are responsible for liaison with special interest groups.
We get requests from the Congressional Office, for instance. These are requests that come directly from congressmen. They are submitted to the Congressional Office here at the White House. The Congressional Office acknowledges them with a simple letter of acknowledgement, not, you know, indicating which way the decision will go, just simply saying that they are forwarding the congressman's request for a message from the president to the appropriate office. It comes here. I then, you know, make the decision whether or not something should be done, and we try wherever possible, of course, to in the case of congressional requests to comply and to stretch policy as much as we can and to do letters addressed to the congressman if we can't do it for someone in, you know, directly for someone in his constituency without sort of violating one of our firm policies. So then, depending on whether it's done, if it's done, we just go ahead and do the message here. If it can't be done, then I call the congressman's office and explain that as much as our congressional office was interested in having something done for the congressman, that it just simply goes very much against our policies, and that if done, it would create a precedent which, you know, would be impossible for us to meet.
What about other offices that are in constant liaison with special interest groups, whether it be Ian Armstrong's office or William Brody's office? Or
There are a number of organizations that will channel their requests to individuals on the White House staff, because that's the area in which those individuals work. In which case, those offices always will, send me memos accompanying the particular letter or request that they got from the organization to see if it can be fulfilled. They all have to do with messages from the president to meetings or what have you. And then again, my office determines whether or not it can be done. I go back to the individual on the White House staff who sent it to me. I report, what the reasons are that it should not be done if it can't be done. And then together we determine what compromise solution we can reach to please the organization, or, you know, and then if no compromise is possible, we call the organization and explain, you know, that it's something that we cannot do. A great number of requests come to me from the scheduling or appointments office, because a great number of organizations write requesting not messages but the president's appearance at their national function, whatever it happens to be. And if the president declines such an invitation, then it automatically is sent over here for message consideration. In many cases, we can't comply with the message, and if none has been requested, we would not, you know, offer one. If a message has been requested, then we, you know, determine whether one can be done or cannot be done, and then again would, you know, either call the organization, explain that it can't be done, send it over to the to one of the agencies for a message from one of the secretaries on behalf of the president, if that's appropriate, and then again I would call the organization and I would explain to them that the president had asked Secretary X to, you know, send a message to them on his behalf, which is generally received, you know, very warmly by the group. If it can be complied with, we do a message right here, and then again I of course consult with the Public Information Office or whatever agency that, you know, organization would fall under, and get their opinions on what the text should be and what can be said to them.
All of the examples that you've given have been cases where an organization was requesting mm-hmm. a message. Mm-hmm. Did you have any standard list of organizations for which you yearly prepared messages?
No. Everything is done on an individual basis and by individual request. And we, many times an organization which will have received a message in a previous year will call and say, may we have another one? And so I insist that they send in a new request, because I think it's important if the file goes through to the president that he has the whole, formal request from the organization explaining what their theme for the year is and so on, whatever it happens, whatever their accomplishments of the past year have been and that sort of thing. And and then of course all of these statements and letters and so on, telegrams that we do in this office are sent when completed to central files, and and everything is readily available, so that if the year after the organization comes back again asking us for a message, we can pull the file and we know exactly what message they were given the year before, whether they were given one, whether it was turned down, why it was turned down, you know, all of that. Right now we're relying on memory because the files aren't available, you know. That's
what was your relationship with the head of the speechwriting staff? Did he review any of the messages that you did?
Jim Keough reviewed them. Ray Price reviewed them. Then when Dave Gergen took over the office, he began by reviewing them the first couple of months, after which he just said, okay, you're on your own, and left it up to me to check everything out. And if I felt that, you know, there was some particular thing that really bothered me, or that I was unsure of, or that I thought might be controversial, I would go in and discuss it with him. But otherwise, he left that up to my judgment, and they went forward to Rosemary Woods for signature without really being reviewed by anyone in between, except those whom I thought should review it. In other words, if I thought that it was a controversial statement, I made sure that some other member of the staff in whose area it fell, you know, saw it and read it and approved it.
When you say that Jim Keough reviewed them, or that Ray Price did they review them only after it was a finished product?
No,
or did
no.
They review
in the
basic evaluation?
In the draft stages. I provided a draft in each case of the, you know, the statement that I thought should go to the organization. And then they would review that statement.
Did you have any form of documentation of why or why not a certain message was written? In other words, after your discussion with the public information officers or the staff who fell into that area?
No. The memo that the public information officer would send to me would, give the appropriate sort of background information about the organization, which would indicate and explain why they, you know, deserve to be honored by a special message.
And would the same thing be true of any time you consulted another member of the White House staff? Was this done
yes,
in memo
yes.
form?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Early.
And also in memo form, I mean, every telephone call that I made from this office relating to any message request that ever came here, there is a memo in files of that telephone call, of the reasons generally why it was turned down, and that it was turned down, and the date that it was turned down. So everything is very...
Yes, I might say that sounds like it's better documented than most of the offices that we've talked with.
Well, I found that to be a problem, quite frankly, myself, in sometimes searching for things that had been written or handled in it.
But memory isn't too good sometimes.
Yeah. That's why I can't, you know, underestimate the role of central files. I mean, I think that, they just do a monumental job, and that without them we'd all be lost. And I think that, you know, very many people, particularly at the beginning of each administration, are just unaware of the importance of files and of the integrity as well as the people who you know, manage that aspect of the White House.
I agree with you. If you could only tell people that.
I know.
I think there was I remember reading an article about you and your staff earlier. I think it may have been early as 1970. It commented on the fact that you had to develop a style to fit each president. Mm-hmm. Is this basically correct, that you did have to develop a new style?
I think it's somewhat correct. I can really only start with Lyndon Johnson, in the sense that before that I didn't do much original writing, you know, except for editing in the first couple of months that I worked here. But it, you know, was very definitely true that I had to change my personal style and develop, you know, a style that was somewhat, hopefully, similar to Lyndon Johnson, because he liked short words, short sentences, short paragraphs. You know, it was a definite stylistic change for me. And since the president himself reviewed these things personally, then it was, you know, just terribly important that they be written, because otherwise they'd come back. In the case of President Nixon, the style again changed. The president's style was, you know, in a sense, really more flowing than that of Lyndon Johnson, in the sense that it, you know, he there was no real effort, it seemed to me, to sort of not use longer words or not have more involved sentences, or you know, there were it wasn't as the style was not the staccato sort of style of Lyndon Johnson.
Was this a conscious effort on your part to change that, or
although I must say I do recall one time that President Johnson had written President Nixon a letter, and I forget what the subject matter was, but President Nixon had circulated it among the White House writing staff, saying, "This is the kind of writing that I wish we could do." So, you know, as an example, so maybe, you know, he would have wished that we would have been more concise and so on. I don't know. But I think that the way we sort of arrived at what I thought was close to the kind of style that, you know, the president might feel comfortable with was by reading messages and statements and speeches written for him, you know, by those who had known him for many, many years and worked with him and so on. And I think that you know, the same thing is true now of President Ford, that you know, it's so important to get guidance from those people who really are familiar with his style and the words that he dislikes, and there are, you know, likes and dislikes. I mean, there were definite things about President Nixon, for instance, that he did not like to begin sentences with I. He did not like to say "please extend" or begin a sentence with "please extend" as in "my greetings," you know, and that sort of thing. There were several things. Now, so many times, you know, you wonder where these preferences came from. Sometimes they were told to you by one of the other writers. Sometimes they, you know, sometimes the president's personal secretary passed them on to somebody. So you never knew, did this come you know, really from the president, or was it somebody who objected to that and thought that the president wouldn't like it, you know.
You never had a hand
telling you
on
his behalf, you know. But in general, we tried to comply with those little messages as they came through to us, you know, avoid, you know, using words or phrases or expressions that were great.
Did you have anything that ever resembled a style manual?
No.
Or if something else, did you have anything in the way of form paragraphs?
No. In my office, simply because I have handled only the national groups and, you know, large events and that sort of thing, and individuals of considerable prominence, these messages were all done originally and from scratch and on an original basis. As the message office, or the number of messages expanded in the Nixon administration, a lot of changes occurred in my office and in my responsibilities, whereas before I had handled in the Johnson administration, all of the president's messages, you know, form messages, form letters, as well as special letters and so on. My office, with myself and a staff of two, handled the whole gamut of messages sent out by the president. The sheer numbers became so great that we couldn't cope. And so, sometime before the campaign, I had a discussion with Jim Keogh and suggested, it was the first campaign, you know, I suggested that he might want to get somebody to handle all the political messages, and then, which was something that I was not really that conversant with anyway, and did not feel that I had a hold on, and so at that time he did divide the office up, and I was to handle all the non-political messages, in other words, messages to all groups that were not specifically Republican. And, you know, the requests may have come in other words, from a political source, but they were to organizations that were non-political. And all the requests that came in for political organizations or messages of that kind were handled elsewhere.
Where were those?
Well, they were handled under Noble Mellencamp and then Roland Elliott. And there was always one person, one writer on one of his, you know, one of his people who would take care of the political messages. And the other thing that Roland Elliott's staff took over, simply because he has a great number of writers and people working for him down there, and is better equipped to handle the bulk of sort of stenographic work and typing and that sort of thing. His office took over all of the form congratulatory messages to which you asked about. In other words, for birthdays, wedding anniversaries, anniversaries of towns, anniversaries of churches, anniversaries of priests, nuns, and ministers. Those were all handled now in Roland Elliott's office. They grew to be so, you know, many of them that my office just couldn't handle the administrative aspects of the whole thing, because, you know, you had to, even though you used only one draft, basically, for each one of these things, you still had to check and see whether the name of the person was spelled right, whether the thing was typed correctly, and whether, you know, so they got the bulk of those are handled in the correspondence section now, and under Roland Elliott.
You were leading right into the question I was going to ask next, and that was, what was your relationship to Roland Elliott's office or the correspondence section?
Well, none except that, you know, we each know and knew then, you know, what our particular responsibilities were, and so if somebody on the staff or from the outside would submit a message request to Roland, he would just ship it up to me. And if at the same time I received a request for a commendation letter, unassociated with any event, but just a letter of commendation for an individual, or you know, a response to just a piece of mail or an individual commenting on some situation, I would send it to Roland. And so that was, you know, we've worked very closely in that respect, and to make sure also that things aren't duplicated, and you know, and so on. So we know that our responsibilities are pretty clearly defined, and we have worked within the limits of, you know, of those responsibilities.
You mentioned you have had two people on your staff.
Yeah.
Has that been consistent throughout the Nixon administration?
That's been consistent. The same two people.
And who are they, and what are their roles?
Well, I have two people, Claudia Kort, K-O-R-T-E, and Shirley Rock, R-O-C-K. Claudia is, although both of them are really have been performing essentially the same functions. I would, you know, say that Claudia is more at the level now of research assistant, and Shirley, although she has research and administrative duties as well, handles the mail and when it first comes in, and goes through the sort of difficult task of coordinating all of the files and the previous correspondence on the matter and so on, and, you know, making sure that everything is up to date. Claudia deals with the agencies where I don't have to call personally. She will make sure that requests that we submit to the agencies for research are returned to us on time, for instance, that the information received back is adequate before she files it in our suspense file to be done, you know, for whenever the date comes along, because we have everything filed according to the date of the event, and we work about 1.5 weeks ahead, so that and then handle each new request naturally as it comes in, if it comes in, many things come in the last minute, but we try to sort of schedule it so that, you know, so that we don't miss anything and so that everything is done in a pretty orderly sort of way.
Does your office do the final form?
Yes, except in cases that we really get in a pinch, in which case we rely on correspondents to just type the messages in final form, but we try not to. In addition to that, Shirley handles my whole telephone log, which is quite a voluminous one, because it contains all of the calls that I make to congressmen's offices, regretting or concerning messages, as well as all of the individuals who call in requesting messages and so on.
You dictate?
And I dictate both memoranda, and I dictate the messages themselves, the texts. I dictate almost exclusively to Claudia, and Claudia, you know, transcribes all the dictation, and she is, you know, that is her principal function, and the research on the requests and so on, and then, you know, where possible, she assists in Shirley's job of opening the mail and, you know, pulling files together. But
does anyone ever assist you in the drafting of messages?
No. Except that I do sometimes get rather deplorable drafts from the agencies themselves, where they don't, you know, sometimes they supply a memo, an information memo. Other times they will just provide a draft that, you know, nearly always has to be totally revised and rewritten. So it's very rare that I'm able to just edit a draft that comes in from an agency generally.
Do other members of the White House staff ever voluntarily or by request prepare any kind of...
No, not even by request. I found that's been the hardest thing to get, particularly members of the, you know, domestic council staff to, you know, supply any sort of information that I need on these things. So generally I try to work up something first and then bring it to them, and then if they disagree, then they will edit me, you know, add and so on, and we work that way. But it, you know, occasionally it happens that somebody does supply me with a draft, but it's not very frequent.
Do you use the research office of the speech writing staff for any background that you may need on?
No. I do all my own research, and the only way sometimes I do, Claudia does go to the library downstairs or the research library here on this floor to sort of look up something that we need a statistic on or something of that nature. But generally we don't go into sort of small statistics and into, you know, detailed statistics. Mm-hmm. And so that it's not really as essential that these things be double and triple checked by the research office, because they aren't that substantively detailed, and there's only so much that can be said in 5 paragraphs, and generally it includes a couple of thoughts, but rarely does it go into actual numbers and figures and that sort of thing that might be incorrect and need to be checked several times. We usually rely on the agency, and then if I have a question about something that the agency has supplied, then I will of course check back with them and say, well, why did you use this word, or why, is it wise to be as positive or as ebullient or as negative or whatever about this particular thing, and that, that sort of thing, but it usually isn't any more detailed than that.
I'm just really kind of curious. I know that, I think that same article that I read about your office mentioned that you were fluent in several languages. Do you write messages in foreign
languages? No. I wish I could. I wish I did use the languages more, but unfortunately that's one thing I've never done. The closest I came to it, I think, was one Christmas when Mrs. Nixon called upon me to narrate the Nutcracker Suite in French to the diplomatic children who were coming here for a reception. but that was the only thing that I can recall that I ever, really used any of my languages on.
Have you written any other types of things, such as speeches?
Not in the Nixon administration. I've written taped messages for the president. In other words, messages that then he has taped, and that where the tape has been played at the convention. That sort of thing I have done on a number of occasions.
And you mentioned that in September 1972, you stopped doing the form letters.
Yes.
Have you done other letters during the Nixon administration?
Only, again, specialized letters that would be commending an individual on receiving a national award, or on a newspaper man on his 60 years of service in the field, or things of that type. The bulk of the messages, though, that I do are still national organization.
Mm-hmm. And did all of the messages that you wrote go out under the president's signature, or did you also draft any for the First Lady?
No.
And any that were referred to cabinet members were drafted elsewhere?
Elsewhere, yes. Yes. Occasionally, very occasionally, I would do something for a member of the staff where it was a little bit more complicated, and I didn't want to just send it down to correspondence and have it be drafted there, then I would do it here myself. But that was very rarely, because I didn't want to get into that sort of thing, because I knew that once I did, every staff member would be sending me things to answer for him, and that the bulk of the presidential mail is so great that I couldn't take that on too. So.
Right. I have mentioned one article which I can't even cite for you, but are there any news articles or magazine articles written about you or your staff which are particularly noteworthy?
There was the Look magazine article that appeared on the right at the beginning of the Nixon administration, on all the under 30 staff, and there were 12 of us. And then it was shortly before Look folded. there was an article written by Paul Healy in the New York News, which was the one, I guess, that got maximum circulation. And then there was one by Mary Kay Presley in the Houston Post. Then there was another one that was written, I guess that was the,
the first one before any of these that was written by Marie Smith, who was then with the Washington Post, and is no longer with them on the women's page of the Post.
And as you can recall, were all of these fairly accurate in describing your...
They were fairly accurate in describing the duties. Naturally, in an article for, public consumption, I would not really go into detail about precisely how much of the writing is mine and how much is the president's, because I feel that, somehow or other, the individuals and groups that get messages sometimes like to think that he sat down and wrote them himself. So, it's not something that you say in an article, even though I'm sure that everybody suspects that he can't possibly, write each one of these.
Were there any other projects that you became involved in just as a result of being on the White House staff? Did you participate in any task forces or any other...
Not really. Not in the Nixon administration, really. There isn't anything that I can think of.
Or were there any meetings which you attended on a regular basis?
Yes, I attended the writers' staff meetings on a regular basis. The whole writers' staff met regularly.
Since you mentioned it for, I think, the Kennedy administration, did you have any connection, or did you work at all with the weekly compilation of public papers?
No. The only way I worked with them is in my own research, because many times I referred back to them. Sure.
Well, I'm sure of that.
But,
I think we've covered most of the basic areas. Are there any particular areas that you feel should be talked about in more depth in the Oral History Project? Anything that I've missed?
I really can't think of any. I think that to list the sort of modus vivendi of the message office in any one brief interview would just be impossible, because not all the examples of why things are done and why they're not done come to mind immediately. But I think that probably from our brief discussion, kind of sense the importance of having a central office, like this, to coordinate it and to have policy that is equal and fair to everybody, and that at the same time, screens things and protects the president from, getting involved in any controversial things or any commercial things that might be commercially exploited.
You said that you use central files on a regular basis. Did we receive any files from your office at the time, right after the resignation?
We never kept any files in my office. You did receive files from my office which were pending requests for messages, which we were holding here to do, for the president's signature, which of course were, not done. But that was the only file source that you received from my office, because we made it a policy not to hold anything after it was completed, to send everything to files so that it would be at our disposal and anybody else's would, able to use it as a...
Did you have any kind of a cron file yourself on any matters that, I'm not speaking of particular messages, but of any inner office memoranda which you received or sent?
I have.
Just relating to your work?
I have an administrative, file, but I rarely sent all of the copies of all of the memos that are in that administrative file are also in central files, because I never send out a memo from my office, however simple, to any other staff member without a copy of it going to central files.
Okay.
So my office has been very,
diligent about using
central files. Very diligent about that. I mean, really, literally nothing that has gone out of my office to, even as far as Dave Gergen's office or you know, Jim Keogh, or whoever person happened to be on the staff, was done without a copy being marked for Central Files.
Are you continuing with the Ford administration?
Yes, I am so far, and I've been asked to, so.
Yeah, that's good. Well, one reason why I was asking that is we'd like to have some kind of forwarding address where we can reach people
sure.
over an
yeah.
extended period.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is your Washington address, as far as you
yes.
know, a good permanent
it
address?
It certainly is, yeah.
Would you, do you have that?
Yes. It's 2475 Virginia Avenue, Northwest, Apartment B24. And should I, for any reason, move, my parents live in Washington, and their address is 4207 45th Street Northwest. That's Washington, D.C., 20016. So that certainly is a safe place, because I'm sure that, you know.
Well, that's the majority of our permanent addresses are usually family
yeah,
addresses.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
The White House staff seems to be very transient, although you've
yeah.
stayed longer than
yes,
a lot of people.
I have.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank
I don't
you
want to take any more of your time.